series of operations in lands occupied since 1948, leaving 11 Israelis dead.
The current Zionist regime doesn't want an escalation to keep its internal status, despite a call for Israelis to carry arms. At the same time, it gives the settlers free hand along with the military practices.
A third Palestinian man was also shot dead after claims he stabbed and injured an Israeli man with a screwdriver on a bus near the illegal settlement of Efrat in Gush Etzion settlement block between Bethlehem and El Khalil. The Israelis are calling for a military campaign in the occupied West Bank, demanding a painful response. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to Israeli crimes, saying they have their hand on the trigger. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
In France, the suburbs around cities are known for being poor, immigrant, often Muslim, and for voting for the left. But a new poll shows that the far right has surged in popularity. At 42% of voter intentions, the far right has become as popular as the three centrist parties combined. It's now only the poorest areas of the suburbs where the stereotype of the so-called red suburb still holds. Overall, 60% of the suburbs are planning to vote for the two political extremes, in a major rejection of the two mainstream parties and President Emmanuel Macron's new party.
These areas feel abandoned by the city centers and the political elite there. So their turn to the political extremes is actually a protest vote. They have a desire to try a different type of politics because they feel that in recent decades, things have only gotten worse for themselves and for France. After decades of alternating power, the mainstream parties are not coming back.
In 2017, the National Front's Marine Le Pen lost in a 66-34% landslide. However, the latest polls show a 53-47% race, which is now within the margin for error. Many Muslims say they are ready to do what was once unthinkable, vote for the far right. Analysts say that suburbs are now voting similar to rural areas and for similar reasons.
10 years ago, people may have voted based on identity issues, but this election is all about class. What we hear voters talking about is inflation, the loss of public services, and unemployment. Mainstream parties don't have a good record on these issues, which have been ignored in this campaign, making these voters even angrier.
The national turn to the right is based on pocketbook issues, but people may also have been persuaded by what's been on the nightly news all year long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As the conflict in Ukraine grinds on, almost 7 million are displaced inside the country and about 4 million people have left their homes in search of shelter abroad. These numbers are increasing on a daily basis. So far, almost 80,000 Ukrainians have arrived in Italy, the majority of whom are women and children, with the most popular destinations being big cities like Milan, Rome and Naples. At the beginning of the war, about 3,000 people were arriving in Italy from Ukraine every day, but now the numbers seem to have slowed. On Thursday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi praised the UN for its contribution to the handling of the refugee crisis.
The UN has been very active in designing humanitarian programs for Ukraine refugees. Bear in mind that while Poland and Romania have received millions of Ukrainians, almost 80,000 refugees have reached Italy so far and about 300,000 have landed in Germany.
Amid the wave of support provided to Ukrainian refugees, aid groups operating in conflict-stricken areas have warned that non-Ukrainians who are trying to flee from Ukraine are facing a number of additional challenges, including legal exclusion from certain forms of help and racial discrimination.
Over 2 million refugees, more than half of the 4 million who have fled the conflict so far, have crossed from Ukraine into Poland. According to figures from the Polish Border Guards, around 4% are not Ukrainian nationals and include significant numbers of African and Asian students.
Reports have emerged that many non-Ukrainians have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
This is unlawful. everyone has the right to leave Ukraine under these circumstances. Ukrainians, with exception of male Ukrainians who are under military rule, but all foreigners in Ukraine, of course, have to be admitted to the neighboring country, Poland, Hungary, or other countries.
Members of the bloc, including Italy, have ratified a 2001 EU directive which grants temporary protection in the event of a mass influx of displaced persons. However, non-Ukrainians have been excluded from the temporary protection scheme.
In this directive, it is foreseen that only those who are directly concerned with a country in crisis are entitled for temporary protection, citizens of that country, and refugees recognized previously in that country, and that other citizens is up to the member states to determine if they would benefit from the temporary protection.
So far, 17 billion euros have been allocated from the EU for Ukrainian refugee reception. However, uncertainty remains around quotas and relocations. Max Civili, Rome.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Palestinians who are most at risk are calling on U.S. Attorneys General to enforce the policies guiding charitable funding, cutting off the material resources of the settler organizations that are systematically and discriminatorily targeting families for displacement. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Mohammad Khatib, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Charitable Donations Are Funding Displacement of Palestinians. Here's the story. Several gunshot bangs pierced the sky. The Zionist regime troops shot a Palestinian protester with live ammunition. Chants and cheers from the Zionist settlers from Modin Elit rang out through the air as they stood upon a mound of dirt overlooking the Zionist apartheid wall. The Zionist regime troops fired multiple rounds of tear gas into the crowds. As protesters scattered to evade the gas and live fire, young volunteer Palestinian paramedics darted through the tear gas to quickly grab and attend to the injured. That 5 minutes of Palestinian nonviolent resistance on April 1st, 2022, captured the essence of Land Day. Despite facing the heavy hand of the Zionist regime military, Palestinian protesters and international solidarity activists refused to leave their land. It's been 46 years since Land Day, a day when Palestinians organized en masse against the Zionist regime program of colonization and indigenous erasure. On March 30, 1976, Palestinians took to their ancestral lands as an act of sumud, of steadfastness, organizing a general strike and protest marches in response to the Zionist regime's decision to confiscate another 20,000 dunams, about 5,000 acres of Palestinian land in the Galilee. The Zionist regime had already taken some 75,000 dunams from the indigenous communities the previous decade. Land Day has always been a point of national unity, bringing together Palestinians on both sides of the Green Line to resist the Zionist colonization. Back in 1976, when the first Land Day occurred, Palestinians understood full well that the land grab by the Zionist regime served several purposes. First, the intent was to expand the Jewish-only settlement in Carmel in the north, as a tactic to limit the natural growth of Palestinian towns. The Zionist regime's planning has always operated on the premise that by taking away the lands of the surrounding Palestinian villages, the communities would have nowhere left to build, that those families would eventually leave for a life outside of historic Palestine. Today, it is easy to see this tactic play out over and over again, whether in the expansions of the Har Homa, Gilo, and Efrat settlements that sealed in and cut off Beit Lahm, or in the building up of the settlements in the Jordan Valley to push Palestinians into ethnic enclaves. So, for the communities of northern Palestine calling for mass mobilization to preserve their lands, including Saknin, Araba, Deir Hana, and others, their future was paramount. Like Palestinians have been doing for generations, they took to the streets knowing that they would face the heavy-handed violence of the Zionist regime, and that some would likely pay for their resistance to colonial violence with their lives. As Palestinians made this call to resist, leaders within the Zionist regime and significant figures of the Zionist public made demands to crush the Palestinians' resolve. On March 28, 1976, the Zionist regime minister of police, Shlomo Hillel, declared that officers were ready to break the Arab villages. The Israeli newspapers attempt to delegitimize the resistance, called it a Moscow-led operation to destroy the state, they claimed baselessly. Others branded it as a violent, racist movement. Then Minister of Education Zevulun Hamer described Palestinians as being a cancer unto the land, land that had always belonged to Palestinians. With the Zionist regime's general public calling for open violence against these Palestinian communities, days before the protest was even to be held, the Zionist regime sent a heavy military presence to the villages, including armored cars. Every Palestinian knew that attending the protest was risking their lives. Not only were they facing physical assaults from the Zionist troops, they were also facing the financial risk of consequences by their Israeli employers for standing up for their own basic human rights. Palestinians have initiated the campaign to defund racism in honor of this tradition and in light of the vital need to address the structures that allow the Israeli settlement to continue. This campaign seeks to stop the exploitation of the United States charitable status to fund the Israeli settler movement. The campaign addresses the financing of Israeli settler colonialism and responds to the decades-long battle to protect the Palestinian lands and resources from the Galilee to Sheikh Jarrah to Berlin in the Negev. These settler organizations, the Israel Land Fund, Ataret Kohanim, Regavim, and others, are the organizations that use hundreds of millions of dollars to shape the Zionist regime's program of indigenous displacement. Look at Regavim which is using U.S. charitable dollars to evict the community of Khan Ahmar. Ataret Kohanim is taking over the petrol hotel at Yafa Gate. Deputy Mayor of Al-Quds and founder of Israeli Land Fund, Aryeh King, targets the families of Sheikh Jarrah. The Palestinians who are most at risk are calling us the United States Attorney General to enforce the policies guiding charitable funding, cutting off the material resources of settler organizations that are systematically and discriminatorily targeting families for displacement.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Ukraine-Russia conflict going on. Kiev complaining to the UN Security Council of Daesh-style butchering of Ukrainians by Russian forces. Moscow denies this and says that it's meant to defame its forces. The U.S. president wants President Putin tried in court over war crimes. Europe is considering clapping further sanctions, this time on Russian oil and coal. At the same time, talks are ongoing between the belligerent side. So what's next? Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafian. Allow me to introduce our guests in this episode of The Spotlight. Editor of The Veterans Today, Mike Harris, joining us out of Phoenix, Arizona. Also with us will be a member of Ukrainian Parliament, Yaroslav Zhelezniak, out of Kyiv.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome both to the show. Now, Mike, my first question for you. Russia has suspended operations, as you might have heard, near capital Kyiv, which it says is a sign of goodwill for negotiations to go on more smoothly. But NATO is saying it's going to reinforce operations in the east and south. So what's the situation like in Ukraine? What's going on?
Well, I believe that the Russian forces are trying to reorganize and restructure their police action into Ukraine. And the problem here is that the ongoing NATO expansion, trying to get Ukraine into this, Russia viewed this as a clear and present danger to their existence and sovereignty as a country. And the US and NATO are both on the wrong side of history. So let's hope that, let's pray for peace in Ukraine, that any bloodshed and violence is kept to a minimum. And let's hope this moves forward peacefully.
Hopefully. Yaroslav, what do you think has happened in the town of Bucha? Is it staged and meant to smear Russian army, as Moscow claims, or did it really happen?
Look, I'm sure it really happened.
Unfortunately, it is not only in Bucha and Irpin. It's a lot of small city towns around Kyiv where I saw by my own eyes this, what happened and result. Sorry, but today we are with our activists sent 300 bags for dead bodies in Irpin and Bucha to gather our bodies.
Yeah, but who did it, Yaroslav? My question, I got to reword my question. It did happen, but who was responsible for this? Russia says there was no evidence at hand. And Labenzia said when Russian forces were there, no such corpses were seen there, and that no proof has
really?
Been offered.
Really? Are you believing in Russian media?
No, I'm asking you.
I'm sure that it's Russian soldiers. I spoke with people who saw Russian soldiers. My friends was in Bucha. They was three weeks in the basement. Russian soldiers made this war crime. I'm from Mariupol. And the things which happening in my native town, what described my sister, my uncle, my other parents, that the things is much more worse than in Bucha, where you have seen in photos. There is crimes, there is rapes, there is death, there is murdering just for fun, and all for this responsible only one country, Russia. They are murderers, they are making war crimes, and there is no doubt that they done it in others' town. So please don't even discuss is this true or not. Is it true? My friend saw it by my own eyes. I saw these dead bodies. It is true. Russia makes war crime every day. Every minute they killing people in Mariupol. Every minute they killing people in Kharkiv. They still there on our Ukrainian land.
Okay. Now, Mike, a Russian UN envoy, told Security Council today that the West doesn't care about Ukraine. They just want to undermine and weaken Russia. Do you agree?
I agree wholeheartedly, 100%. And I disagree with the guest, the member of parliament from Ukraine. The people that I talk to in Ukraine, and I've been to Ukraine a number of times, as a visitor, I have friends there, long-term friends, 10, 15 years, who are telling me exactly the opposite, that it is the Azov Brigade and the right sector that are committing the war crimes, and that they are being supplanted and reinforced with mercenaries from the West and mercenaries from other areas of the world that are helping, that are committing these war crimes against the Ukrainian people. Remember, the whole reason that Putin and Moscow intervened in Ukraine is because of the Ukrainian government shelling Ukrainian citizens living in the Donbas area, Lugansk, Donetsk. And so these things are not to be believed, that the Bucha was a Russian war crime. This is the type of thing that sets up a false flag to blame the other guy for the crimes you commit to win political sympathy from the global audience. And so I don't believe a word that that the Russians are doing this. I've seen the Russians take great losses and trying to preserve Ukrainian civilian lives. And from what I see and from what I hear, talking to direct people on the ground in Ukraine who are longtime Ukrainian citizens, lived there for generations, this is to blame the Azov Brigade and the right sector and others who are committing these crimes. So let's be very clear about that, that this is an article of contention here, that we don't know the truth yet because we're hearing conflicting stories from both sides. This is an information war at this point in time. Who's providing accurate information? And I do not believe anything the Ukrainian government says.
Okay. Yaroslav, go ahead, Yaroslav. And also tell us, because the West is talking about this, and you mentioned it. And Yaroslav, also tell me what the West has done. Has it really offered help?
I have to answer to this liar, Mike. What's your name?
Oh, please don't call me a liar just because there's a disagreement on the facts. That doesn't mean I'm lying.
Thank you. I'm from Mariupol. My sister was there. My friends was there. You are a liar. You are saying lie about Ukraine.
I am not a liar. I resent the fact that you would accuse me of lying because there's different facts that you disagree with. It does not make me a liar.
Any right
one by one, gentlemen, please.
You have not
You are not in our country. You are not under shelling. You have not been in basements for 3 weeks without eat, without food, without electricity. And you now saying that it is all fake? You spoke with some people. You are a liar. You have not spoke any Ukrainian people. Everyone,
war zones
shut
than
up.
You will ever be in your entire lifetime. So don't tell me what it's like to be in a war zone, my friend. Please do not. And do not insult me by calling me a liar. We're disagreeing on facts, okay? You have your
Russia
version of facts. I have my version of facts.
Please be calm.
An honest disagreement does not make either party a liar. So please do not insult me.
Okay, please, Yaroslav.
Eating sons of drinking flat white. You are now saying Russian lies. There is, I am from Mariupol, Azov now protecting my city. I am Russian speaker. Half of my family lives in Russia. But now I know the truth, Russia is killing our people. That it is only one truth. And when you're saying that we are attacking Donbass, I am from Donbass. 15 kilometers from my home is Donbass, Donetsk region. We are not attacking. It's also a lie from Putin. So please, you could speak on other TV, but when you're speaking with me on TV, please don't tell these fakes. Russia war began because Putin wanted to destroy our country. Russian war now killing thousands of our people.
Okay, Yaroslav, can you please answer this question? Because the West is also saying, the U.S. and Europeans are also saying what you are saying. And how much help and assistance have the Western countries offered Ukraine?
There is some assistance, and we are very glad that we have more weapons to protect our country. But we need more. Of course, we need more sanction, not from the West country, from others. For all countries which now protecting human rights, who protecting democracy, who protecting peace in our world, we need more sanction. We want all companies stop trading with Russia, because trading with Russia, it is pain for our death of our children, which have been raped in Bucha by the Russian soldiers, and such bastards like Mike now protecting them and others. We need more sanctions from European Union to switch off all Russian banks, to put embargo on oil and gas. We need more. Sorry, we now protecting not only our country. We are protecting all Europe. We are fighting for democracy. We are fighting with second largest army in the world. Yes, they are weak. They fighting with us 1 month and a half, and they still have not achieved any result. And the way they leave the Kyiv region is only one reason, because they are weak and they have not achieved the aim to occupy Kyiv. And they become failing in this region. But we need more. We need more sanctions, more weapons, more financial support.
All right, Mike, has the West and the U.S. in particular been truthful and sincere in their offer of assistance to Kyiv, or has Mr. Zelensky been left alone on his own and maybe even betrayed, as some people put it?
Well, let's look at how this conflict started. It started back in 2014 when Vicky Noodleman, call her Victoria Nuland now, toppled the duly elected Yanukovych government by a coup that the U.S. spent $5 billion to topple the duly elected government against the will of the Ukrainian people. So the entire Ukrainian government as it exists today is illegitimate on its face, because this was done by a coup. I was in Ukraine in 2004 during the Orange Revolution. I was there 2005, 6, 7, 8, 9, and I observed U.S. Army personnel on the ground training the Ukrainian military at that time. The hotel I was staying in Odessa, they were asking me what my unit was, because I have the you know, veterans today, I have the look and carriage of a military man to this day. But the U.S. is responsible for what's going on in Ukraine today. This has been NATO encroachment. They broke every agreement they ever made with the Soviet Union when the walls came down. They broke all the agreements about no Eastern expansion. That's all they have done, is relentlessly expanded eastward. This is the cause of this conflict, to where the expansion of NATO caused the Russian, and remember, Russia is not the former Soviet Union. It was the former Soviet Union that committed the atrocity of the Holodomor, where they starved 15 million Ukrainians. That was the Bolsheviks. That was the Jewish Bolsheviks who starved the Ukrainian people. And this animosity goes back a very, very long time. And so I would like to see peace brought to the area. I don't want to see any children killed. I don't want to see any women raped or brutalized or murdered. I don't want to see the young service, the active duty, killed in battle. I don't want to see any of this. I want this all to end. So let's find a way, let's focus on finding a way forward where everyone can live in peace and functionality and stop this destruction, this war. This is craziness here. But okay, this goes back to what the United States did when they toppled the Yanukovych government back in 2014.
Okay. And also, Yaroslav, Russia was worried about NATO eastward expansion. It gave the warning several times, and Kiev knew about this. Mr. Zelensky knew about this. And Russia, many analysts said that they are worried that NATO is getting closer and closer to Russian borders. And still, Kiev insisted that they want to be part of NATO, and they didn't care about this red line on the part of the Kremlin. Why?
Because it is our choice. We're an independent country. We're not dependent on Russia. And it is our choice. And if we have been member of NATO, Russia will never attack our country. I don't want to respect any pro-Putin speaker like Mike. He's not telling the truth. It looks like he never been in Ukraine. He never speaks Ukrainian. And now he is just saying what he paid for to say.
That's a fact.
So once again, Ukraine independent country, not U.S., not any other country responsible what we are doing here. I'm member of the Ukrainian parliament. I know what happening in my country and believe it was our choice. Our choice, like a choice of Putin, who once at the night, like Hitler, decided to attack my own country. He done it before in 2014 when he took the part of our country, Crimea and Donbass. My native Donbass. I have lived in Donetsk. I know what I am telling. And now he decided to destroy it. Destroy it in 1, 2, 3 days. He wants to make blitzkrieg. But he failed. Because we have now a strong army. We are protecting our land. And we will protect it. So if you want peace talk, no problem. No problem. It is only one choice by Putin. Take away his army. Take away it from our land. Not killing our people. We are not attacking anyone. Even we are not taking Donbass. We are not taking Russia. They have decided to start war in our century.
Okay. Now, Mike, let's take a look at it from the other side of the story. NATO not accepting, actually, the request on the part of Kiev to be part of NATO. I think it was in 2008 that Germany stopped this. Why didn't NATO accept Ukraine to become part of it?
Well, because some reasonable people within NATO see that taking Ukraine into NATO would be a bridge too far that would provoke Russia, as it indeed has. And so I must disagree with the other guest that Ukraine at this point is not an independent country, because you're begging for food, you're begging for money, you're begging for weapons to fight this fight. So obviously you're not as independent as you think you are. You're highly dependent upon the West at this point in time. And the problem with Ukraine is the massive corruption within Ukraine, where you have Joe Biden laundering money, sending his son as the bagman. You have Nancy Pelosi sending her son as the bagman. Mitt Romney and many other politicians in the U.S. who are wired directly into the money laundering, the human trafficking, the organ trafficking, the weapons trafficking, the drugs trafficking that Ukraine has become a nexus of. And Putin is there reacting to this, trying to get these elements out of there, because Putin's job is to protect Russia against any and all threats. And so by Ukraine, by making itself this hotbed of corruption, has made itself a target because of the bad management of the government of Ukraine. And so Ukraine should clean up their own act and stop these oligarchs who are bleeding the country to death, keeping the people in poverty while they themselves enrich themselves. And this is not a very healthy way to go. I would like to see a very healthy, vibrant, economically vibrant Ukraine, free of corruption. That's what I would like to see from the Ukrainian people, regardless. That's what I would like for them to have is an uncorrupt government, the same as we deserve here in the U.S.
Okay, we have only 2 minutes, Yaroslav. Could you tell us briefly, negotiations have been going on between Moscow and Kiev, and they say that some progress has been made, but fighting is still raging. What's the solution to put an end to this once and for all?
Look, I believe that now Putin is not going to have any solution. He's going to attack South and Donbass. Unfortunately, what we see in Kiev region and other parts of our country when he take off his soldiers, it is just a part of plan. He's regrouping it, and some of the soldiers come back in the southern part or eastern part. Unfortunately, we are now preparing for more fightings because we know from Western intelligence and our own intelligence, he won't attack us. So it looks like Putin is playing negotiation, but his real aims and real target is the same, to destroy our country. And unfortunately, it's not the time for final negotiations, it looks like.
Mike, you have 30 seconds. For Mike, please.
I'm sure that we will win. I'm sure that we will because we are protecting our land.
Okay.
And sorry, but once again, I don't know what such guess like.
Yaroslav, we are out of time. Let's Mike also speak for 30 seconds.
Look, this guy said that we are not independent countries.
It's already a done deal. Russia has won.
You really said that? Have you lesson in geography or something like that?
Okay, that's the end of our show. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you, my guests. Editor of the Veterans Today, Mike Harris in Phoenix, Arizona, and member of the Ukrainian Parliament, Yaroslav Zhelzinyk from Kiev.
Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Following its imperial playbook, the U.S. sanctions imposed on Afghanistan are aimed at destabilizing Afghan civil society, making daily life so unbearable that the Afghan people eventually blame the Taliban for their misery, providing the United States and its proxies an opening to enact regime change, says Zachary Scott Ryder in an article published under the heading, Biden Lies Again, as he covertly continues the U.S. forever war against the Afghan people. Stay tuned for more. Over the past few months, U.S. lawmakers, the Afghan government, and the international community have called on Washington to stop strangling the Afghan economy as its people continue to suffer from a U.S.-created humanitarian crisis. On December 22nd, the Biden administration effectively rejected those calls, opting instead for half measures that will do little to counter the effects of stringent economic sanctions imposed on the Taliban or to improve the material well-being of the Afghan people. Contrary to the narrative of U.S. politicians and journalists, the August 2021 withdrawal of U.S. and NATO forces from Afghanistan did not mark the end of the United States' forever war, but rather a shift in U.S. policy from direct military intervention and occupation to one based on economic sanctions and indirect political subversion. Although the tactics changed, the goal is the same: the accumulation of wealth and power through class warfare against the Afghan people. Just days after Kabul fell to the Taliban on August 15th, Washington took measures to turn off the flow of funds to the new government and paralyze the Afghan banking system. The Treasury Department quickly issued a freeze order on nearly $9.5 billion of the Afghan central bank's assets held in U.S. financial institutions, including the New York Federal Reserve Bank. Although the Taliban was entitled to receive more than $460 million from the International Monetary Fund, IMF, in currency reserves known as Special Drawing Rights, or SDRs, the U.S. directed the IMF to block those funds as well. President Biden has also ensured that $1.3 billion of Afghan funds held in international accounts remain frozen, including funds denominated in euros and British pounds and those held by the Swiss-based bank for international sanctions. Despite purported exemptions for humanitarian aid, the lack of clarity under U.S. law deters financial institutions from processing such transactions out of fear of violating U.S. sanctions, which not only freeze all assets associated with the Taliban, they subject any individual or entity that conducts a transaction involving the Taliban to criminal liability. The ubiquity of U.S. dollars and financial institutions in international commerce provides the U.S. with virtually global jurisdiction. Decades of U.S. occupation and war have left Afghanistan a poor country dependent on external sources to fund public spending. No longer able to rely on brute military and political force to protect the interests of Western capital in Afghanistan, U.S. strategists understand that seizing the central bank's money and cutting all international aid gives Washington powerful leverage against the Taliban, all while inflicting maximum pain on the Afghan people, who continue to be relegated to starving pawns in big power games. The horrific and totally foreseeable consequences of these sanctions have so far been well documented by international humanitarian organizations, even if they are reluctant to depict the United States as culpable. On October 25th, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization and World Food Program published a report urging humanitarian assistance, warning that Afghanistan is on a countdown to catastrophe. According to the report, more than 50% of the Afghans will face crisis or emergency levels of acute food insecurity, including over 3 million children under the age of 5. On November 22nd, the United Nations Development Program published a report warning that Afghanistan's financial and bank payment systems are in disarray and on the verge of collapse. The UNDP report, citing the IMF, predicts the Afghan economy could contract by 30% for 2021 to 2022. On December 6th, the International Crisis Group issued a more scathing report warning that the hunger and destitution caused by economic strangulation imposed by the West in response to the Taliban takeover could kill more Afghans than all the bombs and bullets of the past two decades. In other words, U.S. policy of intentionally starving the Afghan people through economic sanctions on Afghanistan is going as planned. As many predicted, blocking funds from Taliban and curtailing foreign aid and assistance would lead to a rapid financial meltdown and exacerbate the ongoing famine plaguing Afghanistan. Despite the Taliban's success in forcing the U.S. government to negotiating table in Doha and then ousting the U.S. military from Afghanistan, or rather, because of that success, Washington has made it clear that it has no plans to respect Afghanistan's sovereignty. Indeed, the Biden administration's response to pleas that the asset freeze be lifted demonstrates the hypocrisy and callousness of U.S. foreign policy. The U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan, Thomas West, remarks, effectively admitted that the dire situation predates the Taliban takeover and confirmed that the United States was preventing critical international aid from reaching Afghanistan as retribution for the Taliban's military success, while recognizing that Afghanistan's economy is enormously dependent on aid, including for basic services. In tacit acknowledgement that the state needs legitimacy to stabilize its rule, the U.S.-driven humanitarian crisis has prompted members of Congress to ask the Biden administration to reconsider certain aspects of its sanctions policy in light of the dire warnings issued by the UNDP and World Food Program. On December 15th, a bipartisan group of 39 lawmakers wrote a letter to the State and Treasury Departments calling on the Biden administration to allow international financial institutions to inject the necessary economic capital into Afghanistan while avoiding the transfer of money to the Taliban-led government and designated private Afghan or third country bank as a central bank. The lawmakers also recommended, among other things, the release of the $9.5 billion of Afghan assets, but only if sent to an appropriate United Nations agency and only if used to pay teacher salaries and provide meals to children in schools, so long as girls can continue to attend. On December 20th, a group of 46 lawmakers led by the House Progressives wrote a letter to Biden explicitly linking the U.S. confiscation of $9.4 billion of Afghan assets to contributing to soaring inflation and plunging the country deeper into economic and humanitarian crisis. Although the House Progressives struck a harsher tone, they made the same request as the December 19th letter, urging Biden to allow Afghanistan Central Bank to access its reserves, consistent with proposals by current and former Afghan Central Bank officials appointed by the U.S.-supported government and supported by private sector associations such as the Afghan Chamber of Commerce and Investment and the Afghanistan Banks Association. This congressional pushback, tepid as it is, also reflects an inherent tension in the U.S. use of sanctions. While economic warfare is a necessary tool of U.S. foreign policy, sanctions are not always good for business in the short term. Afghanistan had been a source of wealth for the imperialist bourgeois for the past two decades. And now, certain sectors of the capitalist class apparently want back in. Still, the Biden administration has shown no sign of easing the sanctions. In fact, the Biden administration is considering permanently depriving the Afghan people of the funds needed to combat the current humanitarian crisis by transferring those funds instead to U.S. plaintiffs with outstanding default judgments against the Taliban. Although his formal statement is not due until January 18, 2022, the Biden administration seems willing to go along with the plan. The only apparent obstacle is how to seize the Afghan funds without recognizing the Taliban as the legitimate Afghan government. Press Secretary Jen Psaki has twice cited that ongoing litigation as the primary reason for maintaining the asset freeze. Following its imperial playbook, the U.S. sanctions imposed on Afghanistan are aimed at destabilizing Afghan civil society, making daily life so unbearable that the Afghan people eventually blame the Taliban for their misery, providing the United States and its proxies an opening to enact regime change.